our culture today is, you know, through woke ideology, critical race theory, we talk a lot about privilege. We talk a lot about, you know, white privilege, male privilege, Christian privilege, all these different things. But the reality is there is a Western privilege that people do not think about. The Western privilege of suffering being a surprise.
Outstanding is a production of The Washington Stand, where you can find news and commentary from a biblical worldview.
Welcome to Outstanding, where we have critical conversations about the news of the day and the ideas that shape us, all from a Christian worldview. I'm Joseph Backholm, and it's my pleasure to be guiding the conversation today with you. Now, the overturn of Roe versus Wade was not expected to settle the issue of abortion, and it definitely has not. The battle that was returned to the states is raging. And it is likely to be one of the most important issues to voters in the upcoming presidential election. Of course, states have responded in very different ways, with some states banning abortion entirely, while other states have created abortion tourism and pay for the expenses of people to travel to their state for an abortion. So clearly, we have different perspectives on this issue. Meanwhile, the effort to legalize and encourage assisted suicide continues to gain momentum around the globe and also forces us to consider, like abortion does, what makes a life worth living. 14 nations now have a so-called right to die legislation law. And in the Netherlands, they expect 10,000 people to end their own lives under that nation's right to die law. And not all of those cases involve terminal illness. The Dutch government allows doctors to euthanize children as young as 1 year old. Now, obviously, a one-year-old cannot consent to ending their own life. So what's all this mean? Now, here in the U.S., 10 states, along with the District of Columbia, allow assisted suicide. Ironically, some of the nations who have embraced assisted suicide most enthusiastically are also running strong suicide prevention campaigns. Why would that be? Is there a connection between the abortion industry and the assisted suicide industry? Now, are these separate issues or issues that need to be addressed simultaneously? That's what we're going to talk about today. And joining me for this conversation is Samuel Say. And Samuel is the founder of SlowToWrite.com and a contributor to True North Center. He's a former community liaison at the Canadian Center for Bioethical Reform and the former spokesman on critical race theory for Parents as First Educators. Samuel is a Ghanaian Canadian and currently resides in Ohio with his wife and their newborn son. He just wrote about this topic of assisted suicide at World Opinions in an article titled Giving Up on Life, which I commend to you highly. And he joins me now. Samuel, welcome to Outstanding.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
Well, there's a lot on this topic that I want to get into with you. Many observers have said they think the West is in the process of committing suicide, and they kind of mean that metaphorically. But in this case, we're talking about actual suicide. How do you see the West embracing suicide in its laws?
I think I mentioned this in the article. One of the things that's really interesting is that for so long, you know, some might think that, nations outside the West might actually be better on this issue, at least in terms of the suicide rates. But it's actually much worse. Honestly, it even surprised me until I learned about it a few years ago that Ghana, which doesn't talk about suicide at all, it's not talked about. There's a lot of shame. It's a very honor shame culture, and it doesn't get talked about. And I suppose partly because of that, there's a very high suicide rate, higher than the U.S. or Canada, which really surprised me. But in the West, suicide has been a major topic for a long time, especially when it comes to young people. It's been addressed, people that have been, especially in Canada, where I know I mentioned that in the article, there's been a massive social, cultural drive to push against the issue of suicide. And yet, because of us pushing against just biblical values, and because of us embracing horrific views on life, one of the things I always say is that A culture that does not honor God will not honor those made in his image. And you see that in Netherlands and in Canada. These are two nations that have become culturally just. So my wife, her ancestry is Dutch. And I was talking to her dad, who's a pastor, about this recently, where, you know, obviously we know the Reformation was very strong in Netherlands, but over right now in the 21st century, it's become a very secular nation in many ways, very similar to Canada. And that has led to horrific views on the value of life, because we don't value the people who made us. We're going to naturally push against the meaning of life and its value.
You mentioned there kind of how Ghana and your understanding of kind of that culture and then mm-hmm. Canada deals with this very differently. Mm-hmm. What do you attribute the different attitudes toward suicide generally in various countries too? Is that just culture? Of course, religion is part of culture, but how do you see that? Because you do have unique, different perspectives, Ghanaian born, kind of Canadian raised, now you live in the US. How do you see just the different attitudes toward these issues?
Yeah, it's honestly a bit complex because, as I mentioned, suicide rate is higher in Ghana than it is in Canada. But a lot of that, I think, is coming from the honor shame culture in Ghana, where it doesn't get talked about. So because it doesn't get talked about, it's not being addressed. But that's more on the individual basis, where people are not seeking help for a lot of their issues. In Ghana, no one really talks about the issue of depression, the issue of anxiety, or even oftentimes because of how difficult it is to come out of poverty in Ghana. Oftentimes students will have very high suicide rates because if they don't do well in their courses, they fail their family in their minds, and they will think the only option is suicide. But on a social level, on a cultural level, Ghana is an extremely Christian nation, so to speak, right? The politicians, I don't know if we should get into this topic, but just earlier this year, Ghana released, had one of the strongest and so-called anti-LGBT bills in the world. And on all sides, whether it is the more lefts or conservative parties, they were agreed that this, because of our values as a quote unquote Christian nation, Christian culture, we reject, this version of sexuality. So this is a major, major issue. So because of that, sorry, go ahead.
No, since you brought that up, we'll insert a little parenthetical, because we're told here that, Christian imposition of Christian ideas into law is white Christian nationalism, which is of course a form of white supremacy. That doesn't seem like white supremacy would be taking the lead in Ghana. So how do you reconcile those things?
Yeah, well, I've been reading, I'm forgetting the name now. It's been some time since I put it down because it was too much. It was giving me a headache. But there is a book I've been reading from this white woke LGBT activist, and basically making the argument that, Christianity was forced Africa into being so-called the most homophobic or transphobic continent in the world. I'm like, as an African, I can tell you for example, the Matt Walsh, probably seen
yes.
What is a woman?
What is
a woman? It's very much, it just does not, culturally, being a man and being a woman is extremely important. The role of family. I mean, when you have a nation that is struggling with poverty, Ghana, like for example, when you have so much poverty, being a traditional man, traditional woman, traditional family is extremely important. You heavily rely on that. And obviously it's not white supremacist, it's just biblical. And frankly, Ghanaians are very, very, despite, for example, the issue of white supremacy or slavery had a major impact on Ghana. Ghana was one of the nations that was most impacted by slavery. And yet, because Ghanaians see the consequences of paganism or, frankly, Islam in other African nations, we are grateful for God's sovereignty and providence that we, despite the prosperity gospel wreaking havoc in the nation, we're grateful that we have some of the benefits of a Christian culture in the country. So because of that, we're not doing as poorly. I don't mean this economically, but just socially, culturally, as other nations. We've not had a lot of civil wars the way that other nations have, because we've been unified for the last 150 years or 200 years, as you know, by Christianity. So I know we've gone a bit off topic, but I think it's an important thing to talk about, because it does show, to answer your question now, one of the big difference between these two, between Netherlands and Canada or Ghana or other nations, is because there is a Christian mindset amongst them that you don't end your life because your life comes from God. At a very early age, I think Barack Obama, for example, was in Ghana in 2009. And I think one of the things he talked about, I think it was him who said, you can't go anywhere in Ghana without seeing scripture. It's everywhere. Like you'll be calling for a taxi, and it'll be called like divine transportations or something like that. Like there's always some kind of reference to scripture because of the Christian culture we have.
And I, the reason I think this is important to insert in this conversation, we'll get back to the main topic, but this is helpful in our broader conversation in America, because we are told now that the idea that we want to think about public policy through the lens of kind of Christian truth is really just a ruse by white people to maintain power. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, we're told that constantly. Yeah. And I think that's only made by people who have no understanding of how the world actually operates. And they probably have never been outside the country, because Christianity, I mean, believe it or not, is not a primarily white people religion. I mean, of the 8 billion people in the world, most of us aren't white, and most of the church is not white. So the idea that the only people like who believe these things and think that this is going to bless our community if we embrace God's design for humanity are, you know, desperate white American Christians who are just desperate to hold on to their power. It just doesn't, I mean, it doesn't resonate unless you've only like lived your entire life in your suburb.
Exactly. And, you know, obviously within critical race theory, DEI, whatever term you want to use, that kind of I think it's James Lindsay who rightly calls it race Marxism. It's just that they always want to attribute things they don't like to power, right? They want to say these people, what they really want is power. And oftentimes, because they see white people as the very top of oppressors, or particularly white Christians at the very top of the oppressor, they use that argument to really as a tactic to go against real Christianity. There's a book that I always really try to reference to people called White Christian Privilege that really exposes their agenda, where it's really, they'll talk about white privilege and everything else, but really they're using white privilege as a means to talk about, you know who's really the most oppressive or most privileged people in society? It is the Christian. But it seems like when you read the book, they don't want to say, well, that includes Black Christians or African Christians. They say, well, it's really the white Christians who are the very worst. And, you know, again, speaking of how Africans perceive a lot of these things, you know, it's interesting that that a lot of woke people want to say that it's actually, when it comes to the issue of sexuality, they claim that it is white people who are forcing so-called homophobia or Christian values on Africans. But Africans, I can guarantee you, I'm not saying it's right for us to characterize this way, but we actually oftentimes refer to homosexuality as the white man's, issues, sins, bringing it into Africa. Every time, or at least in many ways, or at least the West trying to force it on us. Every time Barack Obama or Kamala Harris will go to Africa, including Ghana, I think last year, where the issue came up, the media, the politicians were like, hey, don't bring that here. That's not our culture. We don't accept it. Don't try to push that agenda on us. So it's actually quite the reverse. It's not what the woke people are trying to say is really happening.
And that's an important perspective. And ultimately, it doesn't. I mean, the primary point is not, are white people forcing this on non-white people, or are non-white people forcing this on white people as Christians, right? The analysis that we're supposed to be going through is this true? Does this conform with what God has told us is good for us, right? And so the other discussion is really a distraction. And so we need to recognize that for what it is. And ultimately, all we care about is, does this conform with God's will for our lives? Not what color is the messenger? That's an unhelpful conversation ultimately. But recognizing that duplicity does help us kind of cut through what is an attempt to manipulate rather than what is actually an attempt to like bring equality to the world. But in this broader conversation, I'm going to try to steer us back if I can make like a connection here, because ultimately this is just all about to what degree does a society and a people submit themselves to like God's will for humanity in this conversation about assisted suicide. And one of the points that you make in your article, because you have a primarily Canadian context, my understanding is that's where you've spent most of your life is in Canada. And you highlight the fact that Justin Trudeau, of course, is the prime minister, maybe not for long, of Canada, but he has, he has been a proponent of assisted suicide laws while simultaneously running very serious anti-suicide campaigns. And those at first blush might seem contradictory. How does a guy like Justin Trudeau reconcile those things in his worldview?
I'll tell you, he's increasingly having difficulty because the inherent contradictions is becoming more and more apparent to a lot of Canadian voters, because it's becoming slightly more controversial because of, I mentioned some of the stories in the article of an autistic woman whose father was pleading with the courts, with a judge, please, please, this is not right. She's not in her right mind. I do not want you to murder my child. And yet they went ahead with it anyways, because it's becoming slightly more, I say slightly intentionally, because unfortunately it's not part of the mainstream it's not part of the mainstream consciousness in Canada, unfortunately, but there are a number of people who are becoming more and more concerned about this. But nevertheless, he's now starting to talk less and less about suicide as a whole, because he's starting to see some of the problems. Nevertheless, the reason why I think he will address both issues is because, he's talked before about knowing people who have been suicidal in the past, and or people who had serious mental health issues. And I think he's talked about his mom, for example, I believe, who's had, mental health issues. And because of that, I think he inherently cares about, I think he does care about the issue. Now, does he have the biblical lens? Definitely not. But I think he does have an interest in that. But because of his unbiblical views, he then thinks the solution to that, when it's become, in his mind, severe, when it comes to older people, especially, I think in part of that, because of his own personal experiences with that, perhaps with his mother or other people, he then thinks maybe then the best way to end their suffering is for us then to have assisted suicide, right? So it's a strange, strange thinking where it's like, well, if it's young people, then maybe, it may seem strange, but maybe it's just the pressures of being young, and you can help them to overcome that. But when it's older people, when it's people who have disabilities, then they don't have hope. Then the only best option for them then is to go to a doctor and then have the very same thing. It's basically, I think I said in an article too, it's basically, obviously you are committing suicide, except you're doing so with the help of people who are supposed to be protecting you, protecting your health.
Now, this momentum that seems to be growing around assisted suicide, I would argue is actually a bit logical based on secular assumptions about our life. And if you start from the place of assuming that our life is without any ultimate purpose, that we weren't created by someone on purpose for a purpose, therefore, the best we can hope for in life is happiness, and our feelings tell us what makes us happy. And if the purpose of our life is to be happy, and we are not experiencing happiness, therefore the purpose of our life is not being fulfilled, though we have tried every avenue we know how to be happy, we have not arrived at happiness. If that's all our existence is from our worldview, Isn't it actually kind of logical to decide at some point, you know, I'm out of here because I don't believe that there is anything after this. I'm just going to check out because all I experience right now is pain. And the only thing I know, the only way I know how to deal with the pain, whether it's physical pain or emotional pain, is just to end my life. And at least I'll be numb at that point. I will cease to exist. And as we have secularized as a culture, as the West, as terrible as that is, and so, even somebody like Justin Trudeau recognizes, because I think it's the law that's written on his heart, that we shouldn't like celebrate suicide. But isn't that a logical conclusion based on the foundation for life that they have set up everything else, including the sexual revolution? Because the sexual revolution is do whatever makes you happy, right? And the thing that's going to make me happy or happiest, at least in least pain, is killing myself. So who are you to object, right?
Not to go into another topic, but I think it was extremely important during, especially in Canada, because of just how our radical policies on COVID. One of the things that was really interesting, and it was true across all Western nations, the only people who did not have a severe a severe crisis, I suppose, in mental health issues, were Christians. That was true in Canada. And that speaks a lot to this, is that the people who understand that secularism is that, you know, those who understand that there is a God, he has created us to worship him, to love him, and there is life after death. You see these things differently. I'm not sure if I should say this as well, because, you know, I never ever was at a point where I was truly thinking about ending my life. But when I was young, I would have moments where I'm like, man, maybe it would be better if I wasn't here. And I can tell you, one of the reasons why, even when I was an unbeliever, I said, there's no way I can do this, is because it's like, there's a God and I would have to answer to him. And that alone made me just think about, okay, how do I wrestle with this? And ultimately, it actually led me to becoming a Christian, because I realized that I didn't want to die, and I didn't want to die because I feared God's wrath, right? And the reality is, Christian theology, as you said, has been the very basis as to why we are against, whether we want to admit it or not, just because it's a law written in our hearts. That's why we are against murder, all kinds of murder. When God said, thou shalt not murder, it was including suicide, right? Just because you're not killing somebody else doesn't mean that you're not killing a person. You are killing. We don't own, the same way that we do not have the authority over our neighbor's life to end their life, we don't have authority over our own life. Right? It is God who gave us life, right? It is God who, who gives us breath. So we do not have the power to take that breath away. So that has a massive, massive impact. You mentioned a sexual revolution, and also especially the issue of abortion. It's not a coincidence that the nation with the most radical laws, or no laws at all, on abortion, Canada, is the only nation with zero laws on abortion. It's not a coincidence that this is the nation that is rapidly becoming the most radical. Netherlands is right now the worst, right? But even Netherlands, they also have radical laws on abortion too. And when they say it is permissible to have a suicide for babies up to a year old, you mentioned I have my son who is just 5 months old. I cannot fathom any issues that he would have that would make me say I should kill my son. It's horrific, horrific, right? I'm saying a lot of things that maybe I shouldn't say, but I'll say this. I got myself in trouble a few weeks ago on social media. I was sleep training my son, and I used the wrong word. I was very tired. I was sleepy, and I used the word discipline to describe sleep training, because in my mind, sleep training, it's training, discipline. I thought it all fell the same. Whatever. I horrible. And the number of people who assumed that meant I was beating up my son, it was crazy. It went viral. It had 20,000 a tweet of 20,000, you know, likes, people saying call CPS, and it was crazy. It became a massive problem. I mentioned that because while people had nefarious reasons and everything too, but for some people, I think they were genuinely concerned for my son. But this Netherlands law, which is not saying hurt the child, but it's saying kill the child, the same people would say this is just because you are protecting, and they're twisted, frankly, satanic thinking. The debased mind, they're saying this is actually helping the child.
And I would say the reason they think it's helpful, the reason they can convert something from a moral evil and rationalize it into a moral good, is because they see pain and discomfort as the greatest evil, because it's interfering with happiness, right? And so they can take that. And I think that is the justification for assisted suicide, which is pain is to be avoided at all costs. And if there is not a medical way to treat it, or if we cannot change the circumstances that will allow us to avoid the pain, then this is our only option. Where the Christian worldview allows us to think about pain and suffering in a different way, comfort is not the greatest good, because we have a promise of eternity, and our circumstances have been turned over to the one who superintends all things. And so we don't have to take the position that it's easy, and we don't have to take the position that it's comfortable, and we don't have to take the position that we enjoy it. But we believe in a God who can work through those things, which is why, you know, and you gave us the example of COVID, but there are things much worse than, you know, COVID lockdowns that people experience in life, where you can have, as Paul describes, the peace that passes all understanding, so that I can have, you know, joy is better than happiness in the midst of circumstances that make happiness and joy seem irrational. But we have a context for them that lets us know, you know, these things are temporary.
Amen. I'm so glad you mentioned this, because, you know, you asked earlier, what is the difference between why is it that Ghana, for example, or Africa has a different mindset on this than the West? Right. And a lot of it comes down to a big part of it. It's obviously the Christian culture, and, you know, in at least some parts of Africa like Ghana. But Dave Chappelle, you know, this has a joke that I think does speak to this. I've always found it very, very interesting. He talks about, and it's Dave Chappelle joke, right? But maybe I'll mention a celebrity. But he mentioned a celebrity who ended up, sadly, committing suicide. And then he talks about having a friend who he was the smartest person in school. He was doing very well. He was, he got into, I think, Harvard or some Ivy League school. And then he ended up dating a girl. And then Dave Chappelle mentions that one time, I think he's at Target or something like that, and he sees this person that the whole community, in the hood, in the ghetto, that they thought he would be the one to make it because he was in Harvard and everything. And then he says that this person now is working at, you know, Target. And then he made the point that, you know, this person never thought about killing himself. And he's making the contrast between someone who grew up in harsh conditions versus a celebrity who had everything but ended up ending their life. His point, and this is what I'm trying to say with Africa versus the West. In Africa, the reason why the government is never going, by the grace of God, never going to propose a bill for just a suicide is because, as you said, we understand very well in Africa, pain is a part of life. That comfort is not the ultimate goal. That suffering is the norm, right? And that we all have to persevere over this. African culture, right, is, even though, as I said, you have individuals, because it doesn't get talked about as much, individuals who do commit suicide. In Ghana, the culture is very heavily against it, to the point that it's unthinkable that a government would suggest that it's actually okay that doctors should end your life. Because one of the things that our culture has taught us is that it's everything. That's why even like amongst young people today, you know, there's so much, there's a mental health issue. I read something about, I think 91% of Gen Z adults have said that anxiety and depression is a major issue for people that like, for like their friends. 91%, right? It's from the data that I was reading, it's a lot higher than it was for even millennials and obviously previous generations. And is that if we're teaching people that your life is all about happiness, your life is all about comfort, and that's really not the norm in life, as blessed as we are in the West in many ways, but when that's not the norm, any kind of experience that will conflict with comfort and happiness, you think, well, something is wrong. This is not right. This is not normal.
Yeah.
And when you perpetually feel that way, because it actually is the norm, then you will think maybe the only option is then for you to end your life. But then, as you said too, one of the saddest things about this is that the reality is suicide does not end the suffering, right? If you're not a believer, suicide does not end the suffering. It only worsens it. And that is one of the most tragic things about this.
Yeah, that's an amazing contrast to make. You know, we talk about fragility in the West, and I actually just went through a book that Abigail Schreier wrote called Bad Therapy. And it's about kind of, this is another risk, a big tangent, but the idea is, you know, reverting to therapy and kind of ruminating on our pain actually causes the mental health problems. One of the best things that you can do when you're experiencing mental distress is think about something else. Just kind of move on. And we are so concerned about our pain that we want to dwell on our pain, and we want to meditate on our pain, and we want to talk about our pain as a way of not ignoring our feelings. And certainly the motives of that are okay. But we have created a culture that really may be coming, and maybe what we're getting at here is cultural fragility, not just individual fragility, where we see pain as an existential crisis. We love that term. Everything is an existential crisis, but all personal discomfort is an existential crisis. And, you know, and you're a new dad and I'm a dad. And one of the most important things we have to teach our kids is just expect pain. And I'm not going to try to protect you from it. I'm going to try to prepare you for it. Right. And if you have a culture that is not prepared for hardship, you know, and that's one of the things that compare, you know, we contrast the greatest generation, which was born in the Depression and then went and defeated evil on the sands of Normandy, right? That's like, that's hardship. That's real hardship.
Yeah.
And now, you know, we freak out when somebody doesn't use our preferred pronouns. And so those are tremendous contrasts generationally. And so that's where you are mentally, right?
Yeah.
You are equipped in different ways to deal with hardship. And I think one of those contexts would see something like suicide as more rational than the other when your expectations are so different. If you expect pain every day, you're not surprised when pain comes. If you're told that pain, you deserve better and pain will never happen, then, you know, when it does occur, that becomes a problem. Of course, none of this is to, you know, minimize the fact that life is hard and people have real challenges and we need communities and scripture and, you know, the church and friends and all of those things to support us through that stuff. So it's not to pretend that we need to ignore these things, but understanding the worldview assumptions and the value judgments and the value system that makes something like a suicide decision more appealing, right?
Exactly. Exactly. You know, our culture today is, you know, through woke ideology, critical race theory, we talk a lot about privilege. We talk a lot about, you know, white privilege, male privilege, Christian privilege, all these different things. But the reality is there is a Western privilege that people do not think about. The Western privilege of suffering being a surprise, you know, where comfort is we expect such a comfortable living. We are become so fragile that, and I don't want to dismiss this, but that the suffering of an illness is strange for us. It's like, what? I think of myself highly by any means, but I was almost dying from malaria when I was in Ghana. But My story, when I tell people about it, I was skin and bones, which is hard to believe now because I'm such a big guy, but I was truly skin and bones, and I thought I was going to die in a hospital. I would never see my parents again, my family again. That was my expectation. I saw people my age at the time, 7, 8 years old, dying. I've seen death at a very young age. I've seen some horrific things that honestly, I've just kind of probably willfully forgotten about. When I mentioned this to a lot of people in the West, they're like, they can't believe some of the things that I've seen in Africa. It's like, yeah, well, it's every other Tuesday, you know? Yeah. And that is a privilege that a lot of people in the West do not realize. So that to the point where when we are dealing with the sting of death, we think the solution for that is actually to speeden the process of death by actually killing ourselves instead of thinking of dying well. You know, and that is something that we need to think about. You know, what does it mean to what does it mean to persevere? What does it mean to live life well? What does it mean to die well?
Yeah. You know, there's another component of this that I want to deal with, because this worldview discussion, I think, can happen with really good intentions. But there is a more nefarious side of this. And one of the points that you made in your article, and you specifically referred to Canadian assisted suicide law, where the Canadian government is saying that one of the benefits of the assisted suicide law is the potential to save money on healthcare costs. And specifically, they said that this law could reduce healthcare costs by somewhere between $35 and $139 million a year. Now, the willingness to say that out loud to me is a surprise. And I know that that's kind of in the back of people's minds. And of course, what's the logic? We know that it's something like 90% of healthcare costs that somebody will experience happen in the last 5 years of their life. So being old is difficult, and there's lots of medical expenses associated with that. And so that's just a financial, practical reality. But essentially, what the Canadian government here is saying is that, hey, we can avoid those costs if instead of treating you, we just kill you or help you kill yourself.
Yeah.
Does that surprise you?
No, not at all. It was very clear. Bill Maher, of all people, I think last week, or maybe it was this week, I don't quite remember, made a point that the so-called free healthcare in Canada is extremely expensive for the government, extremely expensive. And by the way, it's important to mention that of the 14 nations that have suicide or euthanasia laws, almost all of them have so-called free healthcare or government-run healthcare. That's extremely important to think about, that what I would consider socialist healthcare naturally thinks of the greater good, right? In their minds anyways, the greater good, not the individual, it's the greater good. And the greater good is, hey, it's better for the country if these individuals are just not living. And we know that even when it comes to the issue of abortion, right? I think it was the Netherlands themselves or maybe one of their neighbors who boastly said, hey, we've eliminated Down syndrome. Babies are no longer being born with that. Well, it's because they were murdering them, right? So that mindset is not really new. But in Canada, it's because of the nature of the health system being run by the government, there are so many problems with it. We have incredibly high wait lists. It's hard to find a personal doctor. I could not find one for a long time. So I think when that's the case, the reality is the government will see some individuals as burdens. You know, they will not see them as individuals to treat because it's not private, right? You have a private healthcare system, while it might have its own issues, the doctor sees you, maybe I shouldn't say this way, but sees you as a commodity, right? That because you are paying their salary. But when it's run by the government, whether you live or die, you don't really matter to them, right? I don't mean that in a, I just mean just in terms of you're just really a number. But if you are no longer in their minds, burdening them with the cost and everything, then they can save more money. So there are a lot of worldview issues that comes with it in terms of that. But even past that, as I've mentioned, when we've created a society where we are saying that some image bearers are more valuable than others, right? So, for example, going back to the issue of abortion, where we say that if you have Down syndrome, it's better if you're not alive. Well, that mindset, there'll be consequences to that, right? We would take it to the worst form, right? Or at least to the complete form, which is, well, if it's okay to kill some preborn babies because we don't think they're going to be a valuable member of society, that they're not really going to help our system, then why not do the same thing with even 1 year olds, right? Or do the same with elderly people? What value do they have anymore? They're no longer useful. So in many ways, I'm not surprised. Like I said before, Canada has the worst pro-life laws because it has no pro-life laws in the nation. It's not surprised at all that they would have laws that would also support euthanasia and assisted suicide.
Yeah. When you reject the premise that our value comes from the fact that we are image bearers of God, we become assets and liabilities on the government's financial ledger. And so, if a, preborn child or a 1 month old child doesn't really have any value to the government, because they don't have value to the government on their ledger, to be sure. I mean, at least a young person has the potential to be an asset, to fall on the right side of the ledger eventually. But once they start valuing life in financial terms, we get in very dangerous territory. And that's where the risk that the right to die, which is being created, which is at least theoretically being done in the name of compassion, where we're going to help somebody relieve their suffering. But in the back of the mind of the bureaucrat, it's all about finances, because, it's cheaper to end your suffering permanently than it is to treat your suffering. And soon the right to die becomes the duty to die, because it's very easy to tell that person who is suffering, who may not want to die, but just think of, you're going to end your family's pain too, and you're going to stop costing them all this money and all of these things. Yes. And pretty soon it's like, oh, we did this for you compassionately, so at least you have the option. Now you have the situation like I know exists in California, where insurance companies, they will not pay for your treatments, but they will pay, the $99.99, whatever it costs for you to get a cocktail to end your life, right? And the insurance companies are taking the same position, because from an actuarial perspective, of course it makes sense for that person to be dead rather than you to be fulfilling the health insurance policy that you have out on them. So from a public policy perspective, we need to understand kind of the incentives that are being created and just the reality of depraved humanity, of what incentives start to work itself out once we reject the premise that your value is not because of what you can contribute. Your value is not because of what you can do. The value comes from who you are by virtue of being created in the image of God. And once we abandon that, you don't have to necessarily fall into genocide, but the path there, we're going to eradicate Down syndrome. Yeah. You didn't eradicate Down syndrome. You killed all the Down syndrome people, right?
Exactly.
You're not going to eradicate all the cancer patients. You're going to kill all the cancer patients. And we quickly fall into very inhumane, into very inhumane territory.
Yes. And, speaking of just the consequences of abandoning a Christian worldview, one of that, not only by rejecting the value of the image bearer, but it's also by neglecting just the reality of sin, right? Because as you're suggesting, so often these things are, suicide is being encouraged by people that we should be trusting to protect our lives and our health. But there've been so many instances of people who were not, it's come out in Canada and Netherlands as well, where people were not at all thinking about suicide. So for example, there was a man, I think a couple of years ago, who just because of the reality of the economy, just was about to just lose his home and lose everything. And he mentioned that, I think it was, he was in counsel and therapy, you know, speaking of bad therapy. And essentially, he just someone, the person that he was trusting to be helping him with his mental health, just said, hey, have you considered this? It's an option for you, you know, and that person now, I think they applied for it. They were granted permission to, you know, to commit suicide or assist a suicide. But I think because the news went out, I think, I hope this is true, that he ended up kind of rescinding and changing his plans. But because we neglect that there is sin, that there are people, whether it is the government or certain other people in power, that they will. Now, the whole thing itself is abusive, right? To end a life, to unjustly end a life, of course, is naturally abusive. Nevertheless, there are people out there who will abuse this to even worse degrees than we think, which is why now this whole thing is supposed to be about consent, right? They claim it's about, you know, people consenting to die. Well, now when you have children as young as 1 year old, 1 year old being killed under this lie of ending suffering and pain, what is it really doing? These children are not consenting to die, right? It's horrific. But I now have to wonder, how much worse can it get? I mean, we're seeing that already, right? We're in Canada now, just for anything Trudeau, after some pushback, has now kind of postponed this. But if you have anxiety, just anxiety alone, and now the government here is also considering making it available for children under 18 years old as well too. I say here, but I mean in Canada. So Canada naturally is trying to follow the same path that the Dutch have introduced, and it's just really, really saddening that a nation like Canada, our motto is based on Psalm 73. It says from sea to sea, but it means that Christ will have dominion from sea to sea. That was the history that Canada that has been the model. And then obviously the Dutch have also their rich history in the Reformation. America, which is no longer it's not federal here, but you have some states that have embraced these similar laws as well. And it's just really sad to see, again, the consequences of rejecting Christian theology, rejecting God. And by rejecting God, we are rejecting those who are made in his image.
That's really well said. At the risk of stepping all over a really great conclusion, I'm going to ask you, as our resident Canadian today, is Justin Trudeau Fidel Castro's son?
You could have asked me to predict what you were going to say, and I could have given you 1,000 answers, and that would not have been one of the things
that would not have been it.
Going to ask me. No, I find that theory incredibly funny, to be honest with you. I find it hilarious for many, many reasons, but I do not believe that he's but hey,
okay,
would he ever admit to it? Of course not. So
well, for those who want to know more, consult the Google. But Samuel, say thank you so much for your time, and people can find you at slowtowrite.com, and you do great thinking. And I mean, I love the name of that, quick to hear, slow to speak, and sometimes slow to write as well, right? We do try to form slow opinions around here, because informed opinions are better than fast opinions. And amen. Listening a lot before we speak is important, and you do that well. And grateful for your work and your thinking and your ministry and your time today. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
And friends, thank you for joining us. Hope you've enjoyed the conversation as well. If you have, share it with a friend, because that's how they learn about the conversation, and that's how they learn something as well. Make sure you like and subscribe. New episodes every Tuesday and Friday. And if you give us a 5-star review, that helps us make new friends. So please do that. Always love to hear from you. If you have any questions, comments, thoughts, feedback, or suggestions for future shows, love to hear from you. Email me at outstanding@washingtonstand.com. I've enjoyed my time being there with you very much. My name is Joseph Backholm, and this has been Outstanding.
Outstanding is a production of The Washington Stand, where you can find news and commentary from a biblical worldview.